Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we're live for an hour each weekday afternoon with an open phone line to take your questions about the Bible or the Christian life. Or if you disagree with the host about something, you can call and tell us what that is and we can discuss that together. The number to call is 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. Of course, we all just heard, I think maybe about an hour ago, Charlie Kirk was shot while he was answering questions at a university campus in Utah. At this point, I've heard conflicting things. The news report at the top of the hour that we just heard said that he was in bad condition, but I'd already read that he had died. President Trump had announced that Charlie Kirk had died some time ago, actually. And so I guess we're getting different reports. My assumption is that Charlie Kirk has died and that the report we heard on the news a few minutes ago was probably recorded earlier and was not up to date. My guess is if he's dead, he died in the last half hour or so. It's a tremendous loss to my mind. He was a great champion of the truth. He is rational and intelligent and he loved the Lord. So if he's dead, he's gone to be with the Lord now. But this is how the left settles arguments. Really, they don't ever argue, because they have no arguments. There's no rational case for the positions that they champion. And so they just have to kill people. They have to shoot candidates. They have to shoot, people who are on the other side of the aisle. I'm not saying that no conservative has ever done such a thing, because there are indeed conservatives who are deranged, as well as leftists that are deranged. The thing is, it seems like all the shootings lately have been done by the people on the left, and they do this because they cannot answer for themselves. They want to hold positions for which no defense can be given. So their only response is that they settle the argument by killing the person who disagrees with them, which is simply a way of admitting we have no defense for our position. Now, Christians need to be in a position that they can defend their position. Charlie Kirk was certainly excellent at doing that very thing, one of the best of his generation, no doubt. I'm very grieved for his family, and I'm glad for him that he gets to be with the Lord. I wish I could be with the Lord. I'd be glad to go. But on the other hand, he has loved ones, he has children. He's 31 years old, and of course, the forces of sanity were definitely benefited from his activities, and he had just begun a university tour where he's going to be doing this kind of thing at university campuses, and some nut job, obviously, offed him. Now, if the news is that he hasn't died, again, this is so soon after the event, I've heard two different things. It's confirmed that he's dead, okay. So, it's a terrible tragedy for the country and for his family. And it also, of course, the way it's handled will determine whether this kind of thing is encouraged or not. I understand already some of the mainstream media are blaming him for his own death because they said he was involved in hate speech. And when you do hate speech, it begets hateful actions and so forth. No, that's not true. First of all, I've heard him quite a bit. I've never heard him say anything hateful. Again, that's another thing the left does. When you disagree with him, they say you're a hate advocate. I know for a fact that that's not true, because they would say the same thing about my positions, and I'm not a hater. I don't hate anybody, and I'm sure he didn't either. But what's crazy is, even if he was hateful, there's a lot of hateful people out there speaking their minds. It doesn't mean that I can go ahead and kill them because they're saying things that are hateful. The fact that somebody thinks, oh, well, you know, he was speaking hate speech, and so what do you expect? Someone's going to kill him. Well, I don't expect that, not in a civilized nation. But of course, there's a great number of people who have simply left the civilization, and they've gone into irrationality. And I don't know what's behind it. I'm not a conspiracy theorist. I don't have any idea what it is, except I know that it has an awful lot to do with the kind of education people have received the past generation or so. And that is, they've been taught not to think rationally, not to argue from data, not to be logical, to be offended by somebody who disagrees, and to think that some kind of retribution is owed to people who say things you disagree with. That has been what universities have been teaching for, some period of time now. And, of course, it's produced a certain number of people who are simply irrational nut jobs that, you know, what can they do? They can't answer. They can't answer rationally, so let's just kill the guy, which is monstrous, of course. And it's a bad token for the state of the nation. And I'm sure, many of you are grieving. I am too, the loss of his voice. But it's a terrible thing. Enough on that right now. We're not going to be talking about Charlie Kirk through the show. Not that he doesn't deserve to be talked about, but that's not what the program's about. Our program is about questions about the Bible. If you have questions about the Bible or the Christian faith, we'll take your questions. There's one line open as I speak. It's 844-484-5737. Looks like I'm being handed a note here. What's this say here? Oh, okay. Okay, this has to do with the speaking itinerary I'm going on Friday. I'll be in Minnesota. I'll be speaking Friday, Saturday, and Sunday this weekend in Minnesota on eschatological subjects. And the host, the man setting it up, would like me to give out his phone number on the air. Now, we often don't give people's phone numbers out on the air, but there are people who hear me announce things, and they write to me and say, hey, I don't go on the computer. I can't go to your website and learn this stuff. So, if you want to speak to the man who's putting these on to get information from him or something, his name is Mark, and I'm going to give you his phone number if you have something to write down with. His phone number is 612-387-4542. I'll give that again. 612, area code, 387-4542. Okay, and that's Mark, if you want to reach him about the meetings this weekend. We've got two Eddies waiting to talk to me. Eddie from New Haven, Connecticut is first. Hi, Eddie. Welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Steve, how are you today? Yeah, thank you, Steve.
I'm fine.
Bad note there with that news, terrible
yes.
News. But my question to you is this, Steve. And I was asked this with the friends that I study with, and I said, if I'm going to answer honestly to you, I have to, here's going to be my answer. If you and I were first century Jews around the time of Christ, and we grew up in the Torah, and God's our God, and we're doing the commandments and everything, and we went down to where Jesus was teaching, and we overheard him say, believe in God, believe also in me. If a red flag didn't go up in our minds immediately, then we wouldn't really be Jews that honor God. We would say, what did he just say? You put yourself on the same. And I said to them, we could go in any church today, and if I stood up in front of any congregation and said, yes, believe in Jesus our Savior, but also believe in me. You know, Steve, everybody would throw me out of that church. People would say, are you out of your mind putting yourself on the same level as Christ? So when those Jews heard that and said, dude, you could be a nice guy, but you know what you just said? And this is a guy in the flesh saying this. They don't know he's God incarnate. They have no idea. How would they know that? They hear a guy say, believe in God, amen, but believe also in me. Every Jew would have to say, did you hear what that guy just said? And honestly, I would have to say, I would have said the same thing. I would have said, sir, have a nice day. I'll see you later. That's just being honest. And that's the question I have for you.
Okay. First of all, I have a number of things to say. To say, believe in God, believe also in me, would be something that a prophet might say. In fact, in 2 Chronicles 20 and verse 20, Jehoshaphat stood before the people, and he was a godly king, and he said, hear me, O Judah, and you, his inhabitants of Jerusalem, believe in the Lord your God, and you shall be established. Believe in his prophets, and you shall prosper. So he said, believe in the Lord, and also believe in his prophets. Now, even if Jesus was claiming only to be a prophet and nothing more, he might say, believe in the Lord and believe in me, his prophet. Now, Jesus didn't call himself a prophet. Obviously, he was more than a prophet. But the point is, if he was seen as a prophet, it wouldn't be irreligious to say, believe in me. Now, I will say this. When Jesus said that, what you quoted him saying, believe in God, also believe me, he was speaking to his disciples in the upper room just before his death, and they had gotten to know him for 3 years. And it wouldn't sound quite as heretical to them by that point because they'd gotten to know what he stood for, what he was like. Jesus actually was surprised that the Pharisees didn't recognize him as being from God, because he said, if I'm not doing the works of my Father, don't believe in me. But if I do the works of my Father, then believe in me. You know, so, I mean, they had seen that he was doing the very works that God did in the Old Testament through prophets like Moses and like Elijah and Elisha and so forth, same kinds of miracles. Those were clearly known to be God's actions. And he says, if I'm not doing God's actions, then don't believe. In other words, he wasn't doing carnival tricks. He wasn't pulling rabbits out of a hat or anything like that, or sawing a woman in two and then she walks away whole. That wouldn't be the works of God. God never did that kind of stuff. He never made the Statue of Liberty disappear. But the thing is that he did raise the dead. He did heal sicknesses. He did multiply loaves in the time of Elijah. He did those kinds of things. And Jesus is saying, listen, I'm giving you these signs that show that I am God's agent here. And if you don't think so, you know, look at what I'm doing. So I don't know if they would have been. Now, if Jesus had just kind of showed up as a stranger in Galilee and started saying, hey, everybody, believe in me, believe in me, that would have probably caused a lot of negative reactions, and maybe, you know, legitimately. But, you know, when Jesus preached in Galilee, which is where he spent most of his early ministry speaking, he didn't really talk about himself. He talked about, you know, how to be humble, how to be sincere, how not to be have empty religion and not be hypocritical. He taught about loving your neighbor, loving your enemy. He talked about living a holy and righteous life. This is the kind of stuff that a good rabbi would teach if he's really a good rabbi. And it's not the kind of thing that would turn people off immediately. Now, then he would do miracles and they say, wait, he's not just like a rabbi. He's more like a prophet. You know, he's doing the things prophets do. Jesus actually never stood up in a crowd and said, I am the Son of God, or I am God, or even I am the Messiah. Those are statements that never came out of his mouth in public. He did mention to the woman at the well in private that he was the Messiah. He also told his disciples that at Caesarea Philippi when they were alone. And he also mentioned it when he was put under oath on trial before Caiaphas, who said, are you the Messiah, the Son of the Blessed? He said, I am. But apart from that, we have no record of Jesus giving public announcements about him being the Son of God or the Messiah, or certainly God, not. He wasn't saying in public extremely shocking things. And the things he did say that we might call shocking, he said to people in special circumstances, usually his disciples who had seen plenty and had every reason to say, well, you know, I might not have guessed that he was God, but if he says so, I think he has a credible case. Now, if he'd said that to them when he first met them, they probably would have run the other way and probably should have, because they didn't know him. But, you know, he said those words that you quoted to them in the upper room after they'd been with him for 3 years and seen and heard and all of that, and had very good reason to believe that he was not a blasphemer. So, you know, I have sometimes wondered, as I think your question suggests, you know, if I had been, let's just say if I'd been a Pharisee at that time, and this guy comes up, he's a stranger, and he seems to be not keeping the Sabbath, which is, you know, for breaking the law. He lets people who are he touches lepers. He lets a woman with an issue of blood touch his garment. Those things are things that Jews couldn't do under the law. I might say, this is controversial. Maybe this man is not of God. On the other hand, if I heard him say, yeah, well, what about David when he ate the showbread? You don't criticize him for that. And that was against ceremonial law, too. So I'd have to say, well, you got a point there. I think I'd have to be looking at the bigger issues. And what Jesus said the bigger issues were, he said this in Matthew 23:23. He rebuked the Pharisees. He said, you're very, very meticulous in the small matters like paying your tithes, but you neglect the weightier matters of the law, justice and mercy and faithfulness. And it's true that many Jews might not have understood immediately that those are the big issues, but anyone who had meditated on the Psalms and the prophets would know that those were the big issues, because the prophets had said it many times, like Micah 6:8, you know, he's shown you, O man, what is good and what the Lord requires of you, that you do justice and you love mercy and you walk humbly with your God. You know, if someone meditated on the prophets of the Old Testament, they'd realize Jesus had the same message they did. And so, in other words, what may have come off as radically offensive to the Pharisees, because he was taking their religiosity to task, if they were humbly, piously listening to the prophets, they would say, well, you know, what I'm hearing this guy say is pretty much what David and the prophets said. I'm not sure if I would have been smart enough to go the right way there, because if I had a Pharisaic kind of attitude, I might say, well, he's going against our religious traditions. Some people that would stumble, and I'm not sure if it would stumble me or not. It wouldn't at this point in my life, where I'm not really into traditions that much, but maybe if I was raised with them, I'd have a harder time with it. I know they had a hard time with him, but I don't think that they had a right to reject him. I think they should have looked at the overall, character of his ministry and said, well, that does look like what the prophets of God did, you know. I said we have another Eddie waiting. Eddie from Kentucky is on the line. Eddie, welcome.
Yeah, hi, Steve. Thanks for taking my call.
Uh-huh.
Question for you is, I heard a preacher talking the other day. He's talking about the Palestinians. According to a geographical area, he was saying that they were direct descendants from the Philistines. What would you think about that?
I would say, has he done any DNA testing? You know, I'm living on land that used to be run by American Indians, but that doesn't mean I'm their descendant. You know, the different peoples have lived on the same lands at different times. And, the Philistines were there, the Canaanites were there, the Moabites and Edomites at one time were there. There's lots of people who have been there. The fact that the Philistines were once there doesn't tell you that anybody who's there now is descended from them. And I'm going to have to say, I'd like to see the DNA tests that you've done to prove that they are Philistines, because my impression is the Philistines have been pretty much extinct as a people for many, many centuries. My thought, and I think most people's thought, is that the Palestinians are Arabs, and the Arabs are thought to have descended from Ishmael. He was not a Philistine. He was a child of Abraham. So, a preacher who says that, there's certain talking points that preachers hear from someone else and say, oh, that's cool. I'm going to use that. And then it gets passed around, and the people who hear them repeat it, and it gets repeated. It gets to be like an urban legend. I've heard a number of people say, yeah, the Philistines in the Old Testament, that's the Palestinians now. I think, well, okay, I'm listening. Where's the evidence for that? I don't think so. I don't think that's true, but I've never heard him present any evidence. I think they're just assuming. Well, the Philistines were there before Israel was, and, so maybe the people who are there descended from them. I personally don't think that's true. Now, I will say this. What if it was true? What if these were modern-day Philistines? So what? Does God love Philistines? Well, I don't think he loves Philistines because they don't exist. But I think that if they did exist, he'd love them, because Jesus died for him. No greater love has any man than this, that he die for somebody else. And by the way, there are Palestinians who love God. That is, who love Jesus. I think the percentage in the Palestinian community that are Christians is, I think it's about 7%, if I remember my statistics correctly on that. I think about 7% of the Palestinians are Christians. So it wouldn't matter if they're Philistine or Moabite or Edomite or Arab or Jewish, it wouldn't matter what they are. Being a Christian means it doesn't matter what you are other than that. Now, by the way, by contrast, of the Jews in Israel, about one half of 1% are Christians. So, you know, the density of Christians in the Palestinian community is 14 times as great as the density of Christians among Israeli Jews. that doesn't mean anything about the nations. The nations could be both evil. They could be both good. They could be part good, part evil. But the point is, if someone's going to try to make an issue about their race, the Bible makes it very clear. Race doesn't matter to God at all. And there's no Jew or Gentile, barbarian, Scythian, bond or free. All are one in Christ if they're Christian. And if they're not Christian, they're all lost, including Jew and Gentile. You know, everyone who's not saved is lost. So, you know, suppose someone could prove to me that the Palestinians were the descendants of the Philistines. I don't think they can. But if there is some proof of that, if that could happen, I'd say, yeah, so what? How am I supposed to think about them differently? Am I supposed to judge somebody because of their racial background? Isn't that what we call racism? I don't think we're supposed to judge anyone by what their race is, and that's exactly what that pastor seems to be interested in doing. Well, the Palestinians, they're the Philistines. Okay, so what? What if they are? Well, the Philistines were bad. So you'll judge people because of their racial background. Okay. Or would you do that with Jews? Would you judge them because of their racial background? Would you do it with black people? Would you do it with Hispanic people? Well, no, that'd be politically incorrect. Yeah, it's equally politically incorrect to do that with Palestinians or Jews or anyone else. Jew, Gentile, Palestinian, doesn't matter who they are. It doesn't matter who their descendants are. Or, I mean, their ancestors are. So I'm going to say it doesn't matter, but I believe the statistic is false. All right. Let's talk to Brad in Coosie, Idaho. Long time since I've heard from you, Brad.
Hey, you don't know the definition of left.
Of left? Well, I'm just using it the way that we use it nowadays. Okay, maybe left. Yeah, I actually know left is like the opposite of the right. And if I turn my head this way, I'm looking to the left. And now I turn my head, I'm going to the right.
Well,
yeah, but the word left is used a certain way in common speech, metaphorically.
No.
And that's the way I'm using it.
Let me ask you. Let me say something. It's used left by baby boomers, your age.
I'm a baby boomer.
People my
yep.
age,
right, exactly.
Because we've been brainwashed. So left.
No, wait. We're not brainwashed to use a certain word. Baby boomers, like myself and like you, we were raised to use the word left to speak of a certain political orientation. Now, if somebody wants to, take that same word and refer to a different orientation, then I guess they can do that. They can't require that I change my mind about it, but maybe I will over time if they use it differently. But I don't think there's anything moral or immoral about a certain use of a word to describe a certain political orientation. So I can hardly be excited about this. But go ahead and make your point.
Yeah, so what I'm trying to say is I listen to the news all the time, and most of the time on the news, but not on the news that you listen to, because I listen to Internet news, which I know – you quite often say that that's not correct. But I also go to many seminars and many men like you that teach stuff, and the vast majority of people in America refer to left as anti-oligarch or communism. It has nothing to do with what you refer to it as. And so what I'm trying to say to you is the church, especially the people that come from your generation, which is the same as mine, have been thoroughly brainwashed on these very important words.
Now, why is that, Brad, why is that an important word? Why is that an important
word?
Here's
why. Okay. Because the genocide in Palestine is done by the right wing. Okay, it's the fascists that are murdering the Palestinians and genocide. It's not the left wing.
Okay, I didn't say otherwise. I didn't say otherwise.
I know that. See, what you're doing is you're being fooled by the feet of iron and clay, which is what America is. We are that last world empire. You're being fooled because everything that the feet of iron and clay does is try to confuse everybody. So and especially the baby boomer generation is thoroughly confused. Like,
okay,
America never went to the moon, but all the baby boomers believe that we did.
And is the Earth flat too, Brad? Is the Earth flat?
No, the Earth is not flat.
Well, why do you think that? Why do you think that?
Because I've studied it.
So have I, and I don't believe it's flat either. I don't believe it's flat either.
You've never studied if America really went to the moon or not. You just believe it.
And what if I believed it? I don't care if we've been to the moon or not. What if I believed that we did? Tell me exactly how my Christian life is compromised by believing such a thing.
Okay, the reason why American Christianity is so despised by the rest of the world is because American Christians have completely bought into the satanic lies of doublespeak and of turning things upside down.
Okay, the music's playing. I'm out of time for this call, and you're not really giving me any kind of arguments. I don't think we're despised because we believe that man landed on the moon. I've never met anyone who despised Christians because Christians believe that we've been to the moon. I think they despise Christians because we stand for righteousness, if we do. By the way, the ones who don't aren't really Christians anyway. But real Christians stand for righteousness, and Jesus said we would be hated by all for that reason. Not because we believe anything about, what the word left refers to or right refers to, or whether we're on the moon. So it's a non-issue to me, but I appreciate your call. We got to take a break. You're listening to The Narrow Path. Our website is thenarrowpath.com. I have another half hour with you. Don't go away. I'll be back in 30 seconds.
In the series, When Shall These Things Be?, you'll learn that the biblical teaching concerning the rapture, the tribulation, Armageddon, the Antichrist, and the millennium are not necessarily in agreement with the wild sensationalist versions of these doctrines found in popular prophecy teaching and Christian fiction. The lecture series entitled When Shall These Things Be? Can be downloaded without charge from our website, thenarrowpath.com.
Welcome back to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we're live for another half hour taking your calls. If you'd like to be on the program, the number to call is 844-484-5737. I'm going to give this announcement because I don't have very many opportunities to do it between now and the events. I'm speaking this weekend three times, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, in north of Minneapolis, Minnesota. And the person who's hosting that wants me to give his phone number out on the air. I guess that's because people might have questions and about the locations or whatever. If you want to call him, his name is Mark, and this is his phone number. 612-387-4542. That's 612-387-4542. Now, don't call that number trying to get on the air here. He's not here. That's his personal number. If you want information about the events this weekend in the Minneapolis area, that's the man to talk to. He's also hosting it. Yeah, so I guess there's actually in his home one of the meetings. Yeah. The other ones are all posted, yeah. Okay, everything about that is really posted at our website, thenarrowpath.com, under the tab that says Announcements. Okay, we're going to go to the phones again, and let's see, we're going to talk to Yossi from Knoxville, Tennessee. Hi, Yossi, welcome.
Hello. I have a question for Romans 5, 12 through 18, that whole section.
Yeah, me too.
I know you said it's a difficult one to understand, so if you could just help me to kind of, and I've listened to the lectures, but my question is, if Paul seems to be on the thought of justification still, specifically 13 and 14, which justification, that would be a concern for like a post-death issue. So if he's still on that train, I'm just confused on why he's pressing this point of Adam bringing physical death, and also like verse 14, that death reigned from Adam to Moses, even those who didn't sin like Adam. And to me, that sounds like, a person that would be condemned. All that's given to him is just physical death. So I'm just like confused on his train of thought there.
Yeah, well, that is the problem, isn't it? I mean, you've listened to my lectures. You know, I've mentioned that this is considered to be one of the most difficult passages in the entire New Testament to follow Paul's train of thought, because one of the issues is there's a parenthesis, a long one, which breaks up. He begins to talk a certain way. Then there's a long parenthesis before he gets back to what his original subject was. And within that parenthesis, there's another parenthesis. So, and when you have a parenthesis, of course, you're kind of saying something on the side, and then you're going to come back to what you're talking about. So, and by the way, there's no punctuation in the Greek New Testament. So whatever parentheses you find are put there by the translators, but they belong there because Paul does say some parenthetical things. He changes directions a couple times in this section. So, I mean, many New Testament scholars would say, yeah, this section of Romans 5 is the most difficult to follow. And I tend to agree. Now, the first verse in this section is the one verse in the New Testament that Augustine used to prove the doctrine of original sin. He had one verse in the Old Testament, one in the New. The Old Testament verse was Psalm 51:5, where David said, "In sin my mother conceived me." And the other verse was this one, Romans 5:12. "Therefore, just as through one man, sin entered the world, and death through sin, and thus death spread to all men, because all sinned." Now, notice that's not the end of a sentence. There's a dash there in our Bibles because he then goes off in another direction. That's the beginning of the first parenthesis. And before he finishes that parenthesis, he goes off in a third direction. And there's a sub-parenthesis in that. And then eventually, when he's done with all his parentheses, he gets to verse 18 and he starts over because what he said at the beginning is, "Therefore, just as..." et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You expect him to say, "so also." I mean, a sentence that begins with, "just as this is so," that's not a complete sentence. You have to say, "so also this is so." But he's just given the "just as" in verse 12. Then he's gone on a rave for the next, five verses or six. And then he comes back to the subject in verse 18 and starts over with the "just as" again so he can finish it off. So verse 18 says, "Therefore, as through one man's offense, judgment came to all men, resulting in condemnation. Even so," now we get the finishing of that thought, "through one man's righteous act, the free gift came to all men, resulting in justification of life." Now, so the really confusing part, and I'm not saying that the part outside the parenthesis isn't confusing, but the part that's inside is really confusing. Because he goes in verse 13, "For until the law, sin was in the world, but sin is not imputed where there's no law. Nevertheless, sin reigned from Adam to Moses, even over those who had not sinned according to the likeness of the transgression of Adam, who is a type of him who was to come." Now, that's confusing in itself, but then he goes off in another direction and says, "But the free gift is not like the offense. For if by the one man's offense many died, much more the grace of God and the gift of grace, the gift by the grace of the one man, Jesus Christ, abounded to many. And the gift is not like that which came through the one who sinned. For the judgment which came from one offense," blah, blah, blah. He goes off and off. And then verse 17, "For if by one man's offense death reigned through the one, much more those who receive abundance of grace and the gift of righteousness will reign in life through the one, Jesus Christ." That's the end of the larger parenthesis. I have to say, I mean, I spend a long time in my lectures trying to sort that out. I don't have much time to do that here, obviously. I've got my lines full, and it would take a very long time. So I'm going to have to ask you, what is the particular question you're asking about the passage?
It's just that mini parenthesis in 13 and 14. That's just, like, really, really getting me. It seems like... is kind of what you're saying, is to not put too much thought or toil into trying to understand what he's saying.
And 14. Yeah, you can put as much thought and toil into trying to understand it as you want, and maybe you'll get further than I do, and maybe you'll find it easier than I do. Most commentators have a hard time with it. Okay, let me read those. 13 and 14 is the part you're interested in. "For until the law, sin was in the world, but sin was not imputed where there's no law." Now, what he's saying is, from the time of Adam till Moses, before the law, because Moses brought the law, there was still sin. Sin was a problem in the world. That's why there had to be a flood, and that's why Sodom and Gomorrah had to be destroyed. That was all before the law came. But he says sin is not imputed where there's no law. Now, I'm not sure exactly how he means that. It sounds as if he's saying even when people sin, if they have zero awareness of the standards of right and wrong, then they're hardly guilty because they don't know any better. Now, but the only person I would know who has zero understanding of right and wrong would be an infant or a very young child, because they don't have their moral senses, you know, sophisticated enough to know what right and wrong are immediately. That's something you reach a knowledge of that, what's sometimes called the age of accountability. Now, after someone has reached the age of accountability, even if they've never heard the law of God, they would be expected to know that, you know, decency is required, because, of course, you would know that you always know when someone has done wrong to you. And therefore, you know there's right and wrong. That's the thing. You know when somebody has cheated you, when somebody's injured you, when somebody has lied about you. You know that's not right. You know it's wrong for them to do that. And therefore, knowing that, you know there's something of a moral law. You might not have heard the Ten Commandments. You might not have heard the Bible. But you know there's some code that they have violated of right and wrong. And knowledge of that code makes you responsible to keep that code, too. In other words, if they did wrong to you, it would be wrong for you to do the same thing to someone else. So, you know, a child has a developing moral sense, whether they have a religious upbringing or not. Maybe they never heard of the Bible. So, but where there's no law, like when their conscience has no knowledge of law, which I would take to be at infancy, you know, sin is not imputed. That doesn't mean children don't sin from the time they're young, but it's not held against them. It's not imputed to them. When we talk about sin not being imputed, you think of, you know, Psalm 32, verse 1, where David said, how blessed is the man against whom God does not impute sin. But he's talking about, of course, being forgiven of sin in his case. But you know, God's not imputing sin when he's forgiven you. He also has not imputed sin against you when you have no concept of right and wrong, which would only be at the very earliest stages of your life, because you develop that consciousness later on. But he's saying that there was such a thing as sin, and people who didn't know about it couldn't be judged by the law. But now, they could be judged by what they know. You know, in other words, if someone's never heard the Ten Commandments, no one's ever heard the law of Moses, that doesn't mean they don't know anything about right and wrong. The people of Sodom and Gomorrah were doing things that they knew were wrong. You know, the people in the flood, you know, when the earth was filled with violence, they knew they were doing what was wrong. Now, they didn't have the law of Moses to tell them that was wrong. They didn't need that. They would have known that if you come up behind someone, knock them over the head with a stick and take their money, you're doing something that you would disapprove of if someone did that to you. Mm-hmm. And so you know it's wrong. You're just doing it anyway. You're doing what you know is wrong. And that's why Jesus kind of said everything comes down to what you want men to do to you, do that to them. That's loving your neighbor as you love yourself. Anyone could know that code exists. Once they're old enough to know that some things are right and wrong, they'll know, well, I wouldn't want this done to me, that because it would be wrong for someone to do that to me. So if that's a wrong thing for them to do, it's a wrong thing for me to do. So God was, you know, just in imputing sin to them once they knew they had the law of their conscience. They didn't have the law of Moses. And I think what he's saying is even before the law of Moses came, people had a way of knowing, at least within some boundaries, what's right and wrong, and therefore they were condemned by what they knew. But then he says, nevertheless, death reigned from Adam to Moses during that period of time before the law, from the time of Adam till Moses came and brought the law, even over those who had not sinned according to the likeness of the transgression of Adam, who is a type of him who is to come. Now, he's saying people before the law was given were not, when they sinned, they were not breaking an actual written command or an explicit command. God gave Adam an explicit command, don't eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And he did it anyway. He broke an explicit command. So do people who break the law of Moses. God gave explicit commands. But between Adam and Moses, God hadn't given explicit commands. People were expected to know right and wrong from, of course, their conscience and their inherent moral nature. And therefore, they were still subject to death. People were dying, he says, before the time of Moses, even though they weren't breaking a specific command. I think what he's suggesting is there's a sinfulness in their nature that they were submitting to, and that, you know, and they often, I mean, they certainly knew they were doing wrong, And so they died. The wages of sin is death. It's a hard thing to follow his train of thought. I mean, I grant it. In fact, I've never taught this passage without preceding or prefacing my remarks with, yeah, this is an extremely difficult passage to follow.
Yeah.
Fortunately, I think you can get the main message of Romans, even if you kind of walk away from this section saying, I'm not sure I'm getting what he's saying completely. Because I don't think that what he's saying here is essential to understanding the theme of the book. I think the whole section is a parenthesis. In other words, there's a parenthesis within a parenthesis within a parenthesis.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think, like, if he had gone directly from verse 11 in chapter 5 and into chapter 6, I think it would have made perfectly good sense. So there's a sense in which even this segment is a parenthesis. I'm not sure, what was on Paul's mind when he decided to include it, but it has the character of sort of a stream of consciousness where he's kind of saying, people, you know, sinned before the law, but they wasn't like the sin of Adam, and now Christ is, you know, Adam's the type of Christ, and Christ is bringing justification as Adam brought, condemnation. And however, the sin of Adam isn't quite like the sin of Christ, the righteousness of Christ, because of this and that, and he gives like three examples of that,
yeah,
which are not really very easy to understand in themselves. This is a very difficult passage. And, in answering a question on the air with so little time, the best thing I can say is, yeah, I'm not really sure I can follow his train of thought perfectly myself.
Yeah, no, that helps. That helps. Awesome.
It helps to know that I'm ignorant of it, too. Huh? Okay.
Yeah.
That's a relief, huh? Okay. Well, all right, brother. I need to take some more calls. God bless you.
Yes, sir.
All right. Poulos from Vancouver, BC.
Yeah.
Welcome to the Narrow Path. Hi.
Hi, Steve.
Hi.
Hi. My question is from Genesis chapter 1, verse 2, and Isaiah chapter 45, verse 18.
Yeah, I did not make it void. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I understand.
Yeah, so my question is actually, do you think between verse 1 and 2 there's a long period of time or something happened in between? What are your thoughts on it?
I do not, but that's called the gap theory, and the comparison of Genesis 1-2 with Isaiah chapter 45, verse 18, is often one of the main arguments for it. But for those unfamiliar with the theory, and also to answer your question about it, there are those who say that God did not make the earth formless and void. And that's based partly on, or maybe entirely on, Isaiah 45:18, where God says, for thus says the Lord, who created the heavens, who is God, who formed the earth and made it, who has established it, he did not create it void. Actually, most translations say he did not create it in vain. Who formed it to be inhabited. Now, the word void, which is translated in vain in most English translations here, is a Hebrew word that's also used in Genesis 1-2, where it says, of course, Genesis 1-1 says, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. Then verse 2 says, and the earth was formless and void. So we have the impression that God made the earth in a state of voidness, which means emptiness. It didn't have any life, didn't have any form. It was just a shapeless rock covered with water, pretty much what it sounds like it's saying. Now, but Isaiah says God didn't make it void. And it uses the same word that we find in Genesis 1-2 and in Hebrew. Now, the idea there is, well, how do we harmonize this? Well, God made the earth, but he didn't make it void. But why is it void in verse 2 then? They say, well, it became void between verse 1 and verse 2. God didn't make it void, but it became void by verse 2. So they say there's a gap between verses 1 and 2. And they say there was a whole civilization. God, when he first made the earth in Genesis 1-1, didn't make it void. It became void as a result of sin, of an earlier pre-Adamic society, a society that existed before Adam. A pre-Adamic race lived then, they say. And sometimes they say that's when Lucifer fell. It was during that time. They say sometimes that's when the dinosaurs lived. That's why we see their fossils, but we don't see them around. They have a lot of different ways. They say, well, this gap would explain a lot, because this gap could have been millions of years long. That God may have made the earth billions of years ago, like most scientists say, and yet he could have made Adam and Eve 6,000 years ago, and in between the creation of the earth billions of years ago and the creation of man, modern man, thousands of years ago, there was this long gap, and there was a whole civilization God made, and they maybe they were under Lucifer, and when he fell, they became corrupted, and God had to wipe them out, so the earth became covered with water, you know, and so forth. And so, you know, they say all this happened between Genesis 1:1 and Genesis 1:2. And then they say the word was, which you find in verse 2, means became. Not the earth was formless and void. The earth became formless and void. Now, that would explain why God could say, I didn't make it void. It became that way, but not that. Now, in my opinion, that's not a necessary theory, and I don't believe it's a correct one. But what do we do with Isaiah 45:18, where it says, I created the earth and the heavens, I established it, I did not create it void. Well, again, this word void, which is found in Genesis 1:2 and in this passage in Isaiah, and it's used elsewhere in Scripture, the Hebrew word can mean void, like empty, or can mean empty of meaning or in vain, for no purpose. Now, in my opinion, Isaiah has God saying, I didn't make it for no purpose. And that makes pretty good sense in the context. First of all, because he says, I did not create it, we're going to translate that word in vain. That's what most English translations do. So that's the same word as void. I did not make it in vain. I formed it to be inhabited. In other words, I didn't make it for nothing. I made it for the purpose of it being inhabited. And then look at the next verse, because he says in verse 19, I have not spoken in secret in a dark place of the earth. I did not say to the seed of Jacob, seek me in vain. Now, that's the same word. Now, it wouldn't make any sense to translate, I did not tell Jacob, seek me void. The word void wouldn't make sense in that sentence. But he said, I did not say, seek me in vain. In other words, this was not a false, you know, giving them a false hope or something. If you seek me, you'll find me. It's not like I said, seek me, but they couldn't. I didn't say that for nothing. And so both verses, 18 and 19 in Isaiah 45, have the same word. I didn't create the earth in vain. I made it to be inhabited. I didn't tell Israel to seek me in vain. Now, it'd be very unusual if the same word meant in vain in verse 19, but meant void in verse 18. It strikes me as an unlikely thing. So there's absolutely no need to assume that this is telling us that the condition of the earth being void in Genesis 1-2 was not the original condition. I mean, some people say that. That's called the gap theory. Now, one reason I don't believe in the gap theory at all is because of Exodus 19:11. Because when God is giving the Ten Commandments, he gives the command about keeping the Sabbath, and he gives a reason for keeping the Sabbath. He says in Exodus 20, did I say 19? It's 20:11. He says, for in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, the sea, and all that is in them, and he rested on the seventh day. Now, wait a minute. What did he make in a span of 6 days? The heavens and the earth, the sea, and all that is in them. But the gap theory says, no, he made the heavens and the earth a lot earlier than the rest, like maybe billions of years earlier. He made the heaven and the earth billions of years ago, and then all the other stuff he made billions of years later. But God says, no, it was a period of 6 days. In 6 days, the Lord made the heavens and the earth, the sea, and all that is in them. So all of that in Genesis 1 took place, he says, in 6 days. Now, true, some people think days might be symbolic for longer periods of time. I'm not going to go into that controversy at this point. But the point is, he includes the creation of the heaven and the earth in the same sequence as everything else, without the suggestion of billions and billions of years in between, or a different human race before Adam, or dinosaur, you know, any of that stuff. So, no, I don't see it that way, but I understand why some people do, because of that word in the Hebrew, and that would be my response to it. Okay, we're going to speak to, Stephen in Omaha, Nebraska next. Stephen, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hey, good evening. So, your last call may tie into my question. Can you expound on the Book of Enoch? I find it interesting. I'm reading it, and it seems like that is critical information that should be in the standard Bible as we know it.
Well, it should be if it's a true book. Of course, if it's not a true book, there's no reason it should be in the Bible. Obviously, we only want true books in the Bible. So the question is the Book of Enoch a true book? Well, I don't think so. And one reason I don't think so is because it claims to be written by Enoch. And Enoch didn't die, but he left the earth thousands of years before that book came into existence. That book came into existence like 2 centuries before Christ. Enoch died, or left, he didn't die, he was caught up in heaven, before the flood of Noah, which was like, 3,500 years earlier. So I actually don't believe that Enoch wrote it. And I don't know of any real scholars who do believe that Enoch wrote it, because it was produced at a time when the Jews were producing lots of books very much like that book. We call them pseudepigraphal books. Pseudepigraphal means written under an assumed name. And in the 4 centuries before Christ, a lot of books were written by religious Jews that were supposed to be religiously encouraging to the Jews. And they claimed falsely to be written by famous people who had lived and died much earlier. So there's one that claims to be written by Baruch, who is Jeremiah's scribe. There's one called the Testimony of the 12 Patriarchs. The 12 Patriarchs, those are the 12 sons of Jacob. They were long dead before that book came around. And there's, this was kind of typical of the literature written in that intertestamental period. Enoch was written in that time. And like the others, it has the name of somebody as the author who wasn't the real author. Now, many people have found Enoch inspiring, and frankly, the Jews and Christians of the early church liked the Book of Enoch. Jude quotes from it, not necessarily as scripture, but he quotes from it as a familiar work, just like many people quote from the Chronicles of Narnia, or I've sometimes given illustrations from the book called A Pilgrim's Progress. It doesn't belong in the Bible because it's not a true story, but it's an inspiring, edifying Christian book. And many people found Enoch to be edifying, but it was a fabrication. And if someone wants to say it wasn't, then they have to give some kind of a reason to believe that it was written by someone who was inspired, who was allowed to say that he was Enoch, but wasn't, or else that it was written by Enoch. And somehow the man, ascended into heaven, and I guess Noah must have kept the book and taken it in the ark through the flood and copied it down and kept it copied, but that the Jews never had it in their Bible for some reason. I mean, obviously, any books of the Bible that were written before the flood would have to be kept through the ark, but the Jews didn't have the Book of Enoch, not until 200 years before Christ, because it didn't exist, in my opinion. So, that's my exposition on the Book of Enoch. It's an interesting book. A lot of Christians are reading it now. I think largely because of the ministry of Dr. Michael Heiser, the late Dr. Heiser. He said a lot based on the Book of Enoch. I don't think the Book of Enoch is an authority on spiritual things. It's not really written by an inspired author, which is the best reason not to put it in the Bible, because we want the Bible to be a collection of the books that are written by inspired authors. And if a man claims to be somebody he's not, in the first verse of his book, he's lying. He's not telling the truth. And if he's not telling the truth, he's not writing under inspiration of God. So that's my view of the Book of Enoch. Hey, we have quite a few callers still waiting to be on. I'm sorry that we can't get to your call today. We'll be on again tomorrow, Lord willing, unless I get shot making a speech or something. You never know what's going to happen from day to day. Stranger things have happened. I hope that doesn't happen, but if it does, I guess you can listen to the recorded programs. You've been listening to The Narrow Path. Our website is thenarrowpath.com. God bless you.